This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Let's start the half hour with a look at a relatively recent phenomenon in Harrisonburg, the first food truck registered in the city back in 2006. Now, 9 years later, 22 food trucks operate in Harrisonburg with offerings from grilled cheese to Mexican to lobster rolls to barbecue. WMRA's Carol Lofton took a tour and filed this report.
In Harrisonburg, food trucks operate somewhat differently than ones found in bigger cities such as Washington or Richmond. Belin Martinez, owner of the truck Belin's Thrill of the Grill, explains.
The whole thing about food trucks is that you move place to place and you have a good following. But Harrisonburg is a city, but it's a small town. So you don't have enough people to where you can just set up somewhere and then people will see your truck and they'll come to it. There's not that much foot traffic in the city.
So many Harrisonburg food trucks, such as the one owned by Martinez, operate in semi-permanent food truck parks, which are usually privately rented out parking lots, where they stay, working sometimes side by side with a number of other food trucks, unless they have reason to leave for an event. For Martinez, the downtown food truck park he uses as a home base allows him to operate a truck in a city with low foot traffic. Kathleen Mania Casey of Grilled Cheese Mania agrees.
I don't want to be on the road. I want to be very branded. We are very branded. This is where we are. This is when we are here. And this is what we sell.
Over the last 3 years, Grilled Cheese Mania has expanded from one food truck to two, one downtown and one near Hillendale Park. Even when she goes to festivals and events, she doesn't take the trucks, but rather serves food from grills under a tent canopy. But for Stacy Turner, Director of Planning and Community Development for the city, the recent development of the parks and the quickly changing nature of food trucks from moving vendors to semi-permanent restaurant-like businesses produces a number of questions about compliance, regulation, and equity for the city to grapple with.
We don't want to come up with a bunch of regulations that are difficult for the vendors to meet. We want to be sure, you know, that we're looking at the implications to adjacent residential areas, that we're looking at implications to the public streets, to discharges into our sewer system or backflows into the water system. So, you know, we've got these types of things that we're concerned about, but at the same time, we would like to come up with something that does not make it excessively difficult for them to be able to operate. And, you know, it's kind of a fine line.
For entrepreneurs such as Martinez, the lack of regulations that brick-and-mortar restaurants have to deal with is part of the appeal of the trucks to begin with.
Restaurant, you have a lot of overhead to start up, a big startup budget, and then to maintain your operations, the overhead is triple what you would get in a food truck.
He said he eventually hopes to open a restaurant, but the truck allows him to start with a smaller budget and work out the kinks before investing heavily in a building. The food truck park near Hillendale now boasts 4 trucks, but for the first year it existed, Grilled Cheese Mania was the only truck there.
And then other trucks started coming, and people were saying, but you don't like the competition? What do you think about having competition? And I don't think it is competition. It is and it isn't. You know, the more people that come for them, see us too. And I can't feed all of Harrisonburg, so if I could feed all of Harrisonburg, then I would say, yeah, they're competition, but there's enough for everybody. And it keeps everybody on top of their game, too. I think the more people that are around, the better everybody's food will be.
For WMRA News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Unfortunately for Virginia's eastern hemlock trees, there's a little bug that finds them quite tasty. Chances are, if you've seen a hemlock tree recently, it's dead or in the process of dying, all because of an invader called the woolly adelgid. WMRA's Jesse Nadler has the story.
The eastern hemlock is one of those trees that are so ubiquitous you don't even notice it. It's a tall evergreen with soft, silvery green needles and teeny tiny pine cones. They can grow up to 150 feet high and live up to 800 years. They're a mainstay of eastern forests, and they've been dubbed the redwoods of the east.
It's an absolutely irreplaceable tree in our native ecosystem. There is no other tree that can step up to the plate and do what this tree does.
The hemlocks are dying thanks to a nasty little pest called the woolly adelgid. Jennifer Hughes is a Lexington City arborist who's been on a mission to save the hemlock for a decade.
I have a background as a park ranger. I worked in Shenandoah National Park, and over 80% of the hemlocks just in Shenandoah National Park are gone now because of the adelgid.
The hemlock woolly adelgid, or for all you bug nerds out there, the HWA, first came to the eastern United States from Japan in the early 20th century and has run amok ever since because it really doesn't have any native predators in this part of the country. Adelgids feed on the tree's vascular system. They basically starve the tree, robbing it of its nutrients. As it's being slowly killed, the tree sends out a distress signal, which in a cruel twist of irony only draws more adelgids. Hughes takes me to a small row of hemlocks between two parking lots near the area food bank in Lexington to demonstrate an infestation. She flips over a branch. It's covered in small white woolly balls the size of peppercorns.
Adelgid infestation. And you don't need to get too close to notice this white, cottony, fluffy substance on it. And that's the adelgid.
To save this mighty tree from extinction, chemical controls have been used. Imidacloprid is a commonly used insecticide that kills the adelgid but is very toxic to honeybees and other beneficial insects, and it can allow mites to take hold. Hughes has recently begun using an organic, non-petroleum-based horticultural oil to treat diseased trees of Lexington. She shows me another row of hemlocks at the back of Hopkins Green that have been treated with the oil. The needles look great. There's no white, cottony adelgid residue.
And you can see that they're doing a lot better. There's no real signs of infestation. There's a little bit of bronzing.
The problem with the organic oil is that it's expensive, $80 per tree, depending on its size, and it needs to be used every year by a certified tree care expert. There is a third option, one that Jennifer is very hopeful about, but it's still a ways off. The beetle. Dr. Scott Salem is an entomologist at Virginia Tech, and he and his team have been studying the adelgid for 20 years, trying to establish some kind of biological control, meaning something to eat it. Researchers found one. The Laricobius nigrinus was found in the western United States. Since 2003, more than 200,000 of these beetles have been put into the wild to try to save the hemlock. The problem is, you can't just release a bunch of beetles into a new habitat and hope that they do what you want them to do.
Very, very difficult effort and project because of so much variability that occurs in a natural forest setting.
Extreme winter temperatures kill off the beetle. They kill off the adelgid too, but it makes tracking success of this project very difficult. It's also really hard pinpointing the right beetle to adelgid ratio.
You can't build up a population of beetles fast enough to control the adelgid. And I mean, if we could rear them like we could rear mosquitoes or fruit flies or something like that, then, you know, that would be possible. But in our system, we can't produce enough beetles to do that. So what we do is we inoculate them into locations so that and give them time for populations to build up, and eventually they would control. But because the trees can decline more quickly than the populations are allowed to build up, we are proposing to integrate the use of chemical and biological controls.
In other words, it might be a few years before the beetles can be used in any kind of large-scale municipal setting. Until then, it's a mad scramble to save the hemlock.
You just can't watch them die. I mean, if your job is to manage and protect trees, you just can't watch these things die.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Late in June, the U.S. Supreme Court gave same-sex couples the right to marry nationwide. But the fight for equal rights for homosexuals continues in other areas, including legal parenthood. Until recently in Virginia, when a same-sex couple gave birth to a child that was biologically one of the partners, the other partner had no legal claim to that child, even if the couple had been legally married elsewhere. Virginia's recent adjustment to a law about birth certificates has helped to change that. Two Rockingham County women share how these changes are affecting their family's life in this story by Kara Lofton that originally aired in May.
Tell me, what are you? What's that animal?
A cow. What does a cow say?
Meow.
And that's a dog.
That's Kelsey Marker reading to her son, Beckett. Kelsey and Megan Marker married in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 2012. At the time, same-sex marriage was not legal in Virginia. Kelsey explains her decision.
It was important for us to have legal ceremonies so that we could have the paperwork and the documentation stating that we were legally married. We knew that this meant that we wouldn't have any marriage rights in Virginia, but we were okay with that. At the time, we were hopeful that things would change, and we were able to see other states in the nation slowly changing.
Soon after their marriage, the couple began to think about starting a family. Kelsey became pregnant with the help of an anonymous donor, and their son, Beckett, was born in April of 2013.
We got pregnant through a donor, and we learned that in Virginia, only the biological parent would be able to be listed on the birth certificate, and only a man and a woman could be listed on the birth certificate. So I carried Beckett. He is biologically mine. Megan was, of course, part of the pregnancy from day one, day zero even. And we were disappointed to learn that he legally would only be mine, because in Virginia we were not legally married, and a non-legally married couple that is not a man and a woman cannot be joint parents on a birth certificate.
But then, in October of last year, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage in 5 states, including Virginia. In a statement issued that day, Attorney General Mark Herring said that now, quote, same-sex couples in the Commonwealth are entitled to all the rights and privileges of marriage. For Kelsey and Megan, that meant Megan could now legally adopt Beckett. They began to search Harrisonburg and surrounding areas for a family attorney who would take their case and help them go to court to navigate a step-parent adoption, as Megan explains.
Unfortunately, we had a really hard time finding attorneys. Nobody in Harrisonburg had done this. Nobody knew how to do it, and nobody was willing to look into it even, except for Clint Sellers, who is not a family attorney.
But Sellers does happen to be Kelsey Marker's boss. In addition to that personal interest, he found the case attractive from a historical perspective and was interested to see how this new law would affect the work he does on a regular basis, estate planning. Here's Megan again.
He did a lot of research for us and was really great discovering that we did need to go forward with a step-parent adoption. And so we went to court in early March of 2015 and found out that we were actually wrong.
Well, not wrong exactly, but their options had changed. They learned that 2 days before they filed for Megan to adopt Beckett, the Division of Vital Records in Virginia determined that they could reissue birth certificates to families like the Markers who fit a specific set of requirements. The couple must be legally married in a state that recognized same-sex marriage prior to the birth of the child. The child must be biologically related to one of the parents, and the donor must not be able to make any legal claims on the child. In the Markers' case, because they use what is called a double-blind donor, they know nothing about the donor, and he knows nothing about them, they happen to fit those specifications.
The birth certificate would make the other proceedings superfluous, and it's not necessary to go through the step-parent adoption if, as a matter of state law and policy, she can simply be noted as his mother on his birth certificate. And from that then flows all of the benefits that other children enjoy, including the rights to inherit and other property-related rights that affect estates and planning for families.
So now the Markers are waiting. The revised birth certificate is late coming, but Sellers said that's not unusual for state documents and that he believes the change will come through in due time. Megan explains the hurdles that remain, regardless of the Supreme Court's upcoming ruling on same-sex marriage.
Everybody has a different story. I mean, for us, it's about our son, and it's about safety and protection there. But for some people, it's not about children. For some people, it's about supporting their spouse during a medical emergency or crisis. For some, it's about just having that recognition that they had a spouse after death. It's just that everyone has a different story, and they all deserve rights and protection that everyone else in this country is given.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Stanton's prize-winning crossword puzzle setter Matt Gaffney says his brain was evidently hardwired to create puzzles.
The puzzle is still a puzzle to you. It's what is it that has to be done as a puzzle in song?
I wrote a little booklet of puzzles when I was, according to my mom, 3 years old, and it has a little word find, a little word search, a little crossword puzzle, a little connect the dots, and a little anagram page. When I was 13, I have an older sister, and she started to bring home magazines, Dell magazines, Penny Press, of crossword puzzles and a lot of other types of puzzles in there. But I really took to the crosswords, and I have a hyper-competitive personality, so I figured I could write one better than these. So I just started sending them into the magazines. And after a couple rejections, they gave me some good constructive criticism, and then they started to accept them. And from then I thought, well, this would be cool if I could make this into an actual job. That's a long story, but I did make it work in the end.
When they offered you constructive criticism, what was that? What were you not doing that you should?
There's a certain type of crossword puzzle theme called a rebus theme, where in certain squares in the grid, instead of a letter going there, some drawing or certain letters or a number perhaps can go in there. For example, if you had a rebus theme where the solver had to put an ampersand in several of the squares in the grid, standing for the letters A and D, you could have a three-letter answer clued as Halloween stuff, and the answer is candy. Only three letters, because C, the middle letter, is an and, ampersand, and then a Y at the end. So these are pretty common now, but back in 86, they were not as common. And I had one that involved putting a little key, K-E-Y, into certain squares. So you have phrases like monkey around, where you had M-O-N, little key, around, and so on. And I had a couple of little inelegant things in there. So the editor pointed out to me a couple of things that made this less than perfect.
And what was inelegant? Can you describe it?
Yeah. One of the finer points is to split the keyword in different ways. So let's say you were having a crossword where the rebus keyword was USA. You could use just words that have USA all contained in it, like crusade or a sausage pizza or Susan the name. But it's more fun if you split that up in certain ways. Like there was a great running back called Marcus Allen.
Yes.
Or you could even use the Shakespeare play Titus Andronicus. So it splits it by having the first word end in the U.S. and then the second word start with the A.
I want to say one thing right now. You're not looking at notes. And you are rattling stuff off. I'm curious about your brain because it's wired differently than mine.
There is a common link among crossword people that when we see a word, especially a new, interesting-looking word, our mind tends to anagram it, reverse it, chop it up in different ways. In the movie Wordplay, which is a 2006 crossword documentary, one of my crossword idols, a guy named Merle Regal, is interviewed, and he's going down the street driving with the documentary maker, and he's pointing out anagrams of things that he passes by, like Dunkin' Donuts becomes Unkind Donuts if you put the D at the end instead of the beginning. There's an extermination company called Terminix, and whenever I see one of their trucks, my brain makes that word intermix, because that's an anagram of it. I think if I ever write an autobiography, I'm going to title it The Words Won't Leave Me Alone.
You make your living at this?
Yes. I'm 40 now. I haven't done other things since I was probably 25 or 6, but it was always something I was trying to do for a living, you know, from my late teens. And I got kind of fortunate because before the internet, it was kind of just a little branch of publishing. By the late 90s, the crossword software had matured to the point where somebody like me could go around and start to knock on doors. And I went to art websites and political websites and sports websites and said, hey, you need a weekly crossword full of golf entries or Picasso entries. And a bunch of them bit. So that's how I started to make a living at it.
So you're freelancing, essentially.
It's kind of a mishmash. I have regular, you know, weekly or monthly contracts with publications. I write many crossword books. But more and more, my focus is becoming electronic puzzles because this is the way it's going, like everything else. More and more solvers are getting comfortable solving on their phones, on their laptops. So that is opening up whole new structures that constructors like me are trying to exploit. You know, back in the newspaper-only days, you had to physically print and mail a puzzle out to a solver. And before that, you had to market it to them. So it was this huge institutional structure you needed. But now the cost for all those things has been reduced to almost zero. So guys like me are able to make a living at it.
Okay. Look into your crystal ball. And where are you going, Mr. Crossword?
Well, we're not there yet, but I think the day will come in the next between 5 and 10 years when we'll wake up one day and the majority of crossword puzzles solved in this country will be done electronically. The old question used to be, you know, between solvers, pencil or pen, but nobody asks it anymore. Now the question people ask each other is, do you solve on paper or do you solve electronically? So that is certainly the future of crosswords. And like I said, the whole electronic revolution, internet, and all the software that's come with it, it's really enabling people like myself to cut out the publications to a certain degree and build our own groups that like what we do. And we're also able to be much more niche. You know, back when a person living in a medium-sized city might only have access to 3 or 4 different crosswords. But now online, you can have access to hipster music crosswords or music crosswords for people in their 60s or kids crosswords, you know, easy kids crosswords, tougher. You have all kinds of little niches. So that's an exciting aspect of this, too.
Going back to wordplay, almost all I know about setting crosswords comes from watching that. It's a wonderful documentary. What level of difficulty do you usually set?
It varies. My contest crossword is really aimed at the top 1 or 2% of solvers. These are pretty difficult.
That's your weekly one on your website.
That's my weekly one. I publish every Friday. You have to be a pretty good solver to work that. I should say maybe it's the top 5% of solvers. But anyway, there's a secondary puzzle attached to those crosswords called a meta puzzle, which is what makes them a contest instead of a regular crossword. But I also do other things because that's leaving 95% of solvers out of the picture. So what I also do is write a free daily mini puzzle, 11 by 13 squares, which is about 2/3 of the size of a normal daily size crossword. It's designed to be easy. I write it so my mom can solve it. If she can't solve it, then it's got words in it that I don't want in there because it's going to exclude a lot of people from figuring it out. We crossword writers labor under these delusions that people care if we sneak all these cool letters like X, Q, and Z, and J in the grid and have these clever little clues and stuff. And people like that. But the one thing that will bring people back to your crossword the next day is, were they able to solve it? If they were, they're very likely to come back. If they weren't, probably not.
So they want to be stretched but not baffled.
That's a good way to put it.
What is your proudest to date crossword accomplishment?
There's a thing called the Orca Awards, which is kind of like a Oscars for crossword puzzle writers. And I did win Puzzle of the Year, a couple years ago. And then I won Constructor of the Year last year. That was a nice recognition,
you're
you know.
You're a rock star.
Well, you know, you like to be recognized by your colleagues.
And suppose you find the answer to...
You'll find a link to Matt Gaffney's website, as well as one to Moving Day, his 2011 Orca-winning Puzzle of the Year, on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, comes from Bib and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. And you, too, can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads-up on our coverage, and you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll see you in the morning.